now. This is my wife, Ann, but she can introduce herself in a minute. I'm a parish pastor in La Jolla, California, just outside of San Diego. Have been at Holden a couple times before this, although it's been a long time ago, almost 10 years ago, so it's kind of fun to be back. And we were asked to pinch hit for the Bible study this morning because Barbara is out on a long hike to Cloudy Pass, I believe it is. So we're very glad to do that, and glad to do it around a couple of parables. We want to share two reflections on two parables this morning. What we're calling the good bad guy and the bad good guy. The parables of the Good Samaritan and the rich man and Lazarus, which coincidentally I think fit very nicely with this theme of embracing the contraries, and we will discover those as we go along. You'll find that one of the main things that we want to stress about the parables is that it's not so much a matter of us interpreting the story, although often we tend to approach the parables with that kind of a thought. How do we interpret this story and pull out whatever moral meaning there is to guide us in our daily living? We're trying to approach parables from the standpoint that it's more a question of how the parable interprets us. I was reminded of a story that I think was actually, I first read in one of Mary Schramm's books. She talked about a woman who's in an art gallery looking at this very famous painting, and she stands there for a long while and then finally sort of says, well, I don't see what's so great about this painting. And the museum guard, whose job it is, to watch people through the day, is standing there and overhears her and says, "Madam, the painting is not on trial here. You are." And so it's somewhat similar when we read the parable. It's not so much that we are interpreting the parable as that the parable interprets us. And if you note the frequent reactions in the New Testament to how people responded when Jesus told parables, you often find right after the parable some scene like, and they took up stones to drive him out of the village, or whatever. People understood that these were stories that were interpreting them, that hit very close to home, and they were not always comfortable. So we should expect some resistance as we read these stories and as they sink in, but hopefully they can interpret our lives in such a way as to really open us up to some new things.
Okay, well, I'm Ann Palmerton. This is my first time at Holden. It's been a delight to hike and get away. We're both here on study leave. I'm a Presbyterian pastor in San Diego. So we have what we like to call ecumenical dialogue together. And as we begin this study of these two parables, I would invite you to ask your questions of clarification throughout. But what Brad and I have thought is that rather than have discussion throughout the entire presentation, that we'd kind of like to get some of these things on the table first, and then to use Barb Rossing's image to kind of feast on them together after we've presented some things. So if you have questions of clarification, please feel free to ask them. But I think for just a couple minutes, we'd like to put some things on the table.
Yeah. Well, let me invite you to turn to the 10th chapter of Luke, and let's dig into this parable of the Good Samaritan. We may in the end decide that calling it the parable of the Good Samaritan is not the best title. Many parables could probably be better titled, but for familiarity's sake, we'll refer to it that way for now. If you look at starting Luke chapter 10, about verse 25, we'll find that the first decision that we have to make when we look at this parable in particular, but almost any parable, is where should you really start reading? It makes a fairly big difference. When this parable is read in our lectionary series, and in fact it'll be coming up just a few weeks from now on the 9th of July, the lectionary calls for us to start this lesson at verse 25 and read all the way through verse 37. I think that there are some reasons maybe not to read all that, at least for our study purpose this morning. Let me just share a couple of those with you, and then let's read the parable through itself. If you notice, starting at verse 25, we have some interpretive material. Someone has come to Jesus asking a question. A lawyer stood up, put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" So forth. If we were to look, and we won't take time to do this, but if we were to look in both Mark's account of the gospel and Matthew's account of the gospel, there are incidents very similar to this, where someone is coming to Jesus asking a question about the neighbor. In those accounts, the explanation does not include this parable of the Good Samaritan. It's found only in Luke. So there's some reason to believe that perhaps Luke inherited the incident where the person comes asking Jesus about who is my neighbor, had the source of Jesus' parable, and decided this would be the best way to unfold this meaning. We'll put the question together with the parable. But the fact that the parable doesn't surface in the other two Gospels leaves some question as to whether it was originally unfolded in this context or not. Maybe more to the point, though, is Luke's version itself. If you take a close look at verses 25 through 29, you'll see that when we talk about the neighbor, the neighbor is referred to here as the one who receives the help, right? You are to love God with all your heart, with all your soul, all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. So the neighbor is framed up as the one who receives help. But at the end, in verse 36-37, Jesus poses this question, which of these three do you think proved neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers? And he said, well, the one who showed him mercy. Now the neighbor is not the one who receives the help, but the one who helped. So there's a kind of internal inconsistency in how this is portrayed, which again makes you think, well, maybe Luke was dealing with a couple different kinds of material and building it all in general around the theme of neighbor. So what I'd like to suggest is that we just sort of pare back the interpretive material and look at the story itself as best we can. We can come back to the interpretive sections at the end and try to build around their meaning too, but for now I'd like to suggest that we simply read the story itself, which I think starts then at verse 30 and goes through verse 36. Could I get a volunteer to read that out loud for us? Luke 10, 30 to 36, please.
Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion, and went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own beast, and brought him to an inn, and took care of him. And the next day he took up 2 denarii, and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back.' Which of these three do you think proved a neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?"
Okay, thanks. Well, I didn't see anybody fall off their chair, you know, when the story was read, which probably has something to do with the fact that we need to learn a little bit about who Jews and Samaritans were and how they related so that the story can have some impact for us. Wanted to say also that in terms of this interpretive material that Luke maybe has surrounded the story with, one of maybe the unfortunate outcomes of that is that the story has often been used as kind of just a moral example. You know, this is how to be kind to your neighbor, which is not a bad point, but the parable, it seems to me, is much richer than just that. On the other hand, John Crosson, who wrote this book, The Dark Interval, and also another wonderful book on parables called In Parables, he makes the point that maybe it's not so surprising that this story, almost immediately, as soon as it was written down, turned into a kind of moral example. Because as soon as the gospel began to spread outside of the Jewish world to the Gentile community, immediately this tension between the Jews and the Samaritans was lost, and you had to start explaining it. And as soon as you have to start explaining the tension between Jews and Samaritans, the edge is lost, and you don't fall off your chair, and so forth. So it was almost inevitable from the very beginning that this story was going to lose some of its edge, and we have to work to come back to try to recapture that. But there are some other ways that this story has been interpreted through time, and Anne has some insights on that.
Okay. Well, one of the ways that people have kind of fallen into a rut with interpreting parables is to make them into moral example stories, which Brad mentioned. But another way, and a way that has long historical roots, is to make a parable like an allegory, which would mean that every character or every thing in the parable has a one-on-one correspondence to something else. So this is the way that one of the great church fathers, Origen, interpreted this parable, the Good Samaritan. I just want to kind of give it to you because it gives an idea of how complicated the thinking is, but also how it takes you on a path down the road. Origen thought that the man was Adam. Man was walking from Jerusalem, which he saw as heaven, to Jericho, which he saw as the world. So here's Adam walking along from heaven to the world. He falls among robbers who are the devil, who beat him and leave him to die. And then who walks by? A priest walks by. And to Origen, the priest represented the law. And the law walks on the other side. And then who walks by? A Levite, who to Origen represented the prophets, again, on the other side. Third person who walks by is the Samaritan, who represents, this is the good guy. Right, Christ. Right, so there's Christ in the picture, who picks him up, puts him on the donkey, and takes him to the inn, which to Origen represented the church. So you're starting to get this whole picture. And then when he pays the two denarii, they to Origen represented the Father and the Son. So now you're starting, the Trinity's starting to swirl around in there. And then when the Samaritan leaves and promises to return, he saw that as Christ's second coming. So in an amazing kind of way, in this small little parable, he allegorized it to an extent that it really kind of lost the punch and became a microcosm for the whole gospel. So that's a way, a path that we don't want to take this morning. I know, unfortunately.
It's all the fun.
Unfortunately. And then just a couple particulars about our story. The road from Jerusalem to Jericho was a notoriously difficult road to walk, and there were often robbers lurking there. And have any of you been to the Holy Land and actually taken this kind of, supposedly there's a real drop in altitude, so it's steep. What would be the comparison here at Holden Village? Okay. Yeah, coming down.
Drop lots from of here down to the
yeah. 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 Yeah, switchbacks.
It's about 3,000 feet, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. And real tricky. And another point that we need to keep in mind is that the priests were the descendants of Aaron, Moses' brother. And the priestly line, they were only one notch lower than the high priests in the whole clerical structure there. And they were the ones who could offer sacrifices in the temple. So they were really important, significant people.
And on the other hand, there are the Levites. And I looked in the library for a book by Irenaeus, and here's one of his books, The Parables of Jesus. He has another book called Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus, and I know it's in the library, but it wasn't on the shelf this morning. He does a nice job of explaining some of this background material that's helpful in the parables, like who are the priests and who are the Levites. I learned some things about who the Levites were, for instance, that they are a kind of minor order of the clergy. They had some lesser duties, not as extensive as the priests. They were in charge of the music in the temple. The Levites were the people who sort of formed the temple police force. You remember on the night of Jesus' betrayal, when he's surrounded in the garden, And he says to the people who come, day by day I was teaching in the temple and you did not seize me then, probably talking to Levites who were given that sort of sergeant-at-arms type function. So the Levites are a kind of second order of the clergy, descendants of Levi, one of the 12 tribes. Take this a little further.
Okay, who were the Samaritans then, is the question that we need to ask. And the Samaritans were people who lived mostly in the area north of Jerusalem. And their ancestors had been conquered by the Assyrians, who had kind of swept over there into the western area way back in 722 BC. And they had intermarried with the Samaritans, and that was part of the reason why the Jews hated them so much, because of the intermarriage. But the another reason was that the Samaritans really kind of latched on to the first five books of the Old Testament. That is, they really followed the law of Moses, and they believed that the true temple should be built on this mountain called Mount Gerizim, rather than in Jerusalem. So there's this theological difference, as well as the difference with the intermarriage, that they were actually racially different as well.
Maybe let's, at this point, just take a moment and see if there are any questions we need to surface. Is this background information helpful? Does this surface any questions for you about who's who in the story and what's going on here?
Did the Samaritans actually have their temple or a Mount Gerizim or not? Did they have a temple?
I believe so.
Did
right?
They?
Yeah.
I never heard that. I knew that she said that, you know.
Well,
the Samaritan woman.
Right, at the
yes,
well.
Yes,
exactly.
The story from John's Gospel.
Yeah.
Right.
But I didn't know if there was a building there.
I don't think, whatever they had was not nearly so elaborate as what happened in Jerusalem with the magnificence of the temple that had been there. But yes, some sort of worship was going on Mount Gerizim. Yeah. Yeah. Well, are we ready to launch off into some interpretation of this and see where it takes us?
I just had one thought, picking up on your metaphor of the painting, in that when I go to a gallery, I often look at a painting in different levels. So I hadn't heard Origen's allegorical thing, but that added something to the feast for me. And to be able to look at it sometimes as a personal thing and sometimes as a more cosmic thing was helpful. It just added some depth to the story, and I think it's fun to look at things in new ways and not give up the other ways as well.
I think one thing to keep in mind about the allegorizing way of looking at it, though, is that when we get into the business of assigning meaning to this and that and that and that, it takes some of the power away from the parable to assign meaning to us, you know, because in Origen's whole schema there, where do you and I find ourselves? He's got everything laid out right down to the two denarii being the Father and the Son. I mean, where am I in that? It can be a way to distance myself, you know, from the story, and I kind of objectify it, and then we're left to say, well, where do I climb in there?
Well,
that may become more clear in this second parable
we
want to do today.
But what was his allegory for the person that was robbed?
Adam.
Okay, that was Adam. If we think of ourselves as a part of the whole human race,
sure,
and of Adam, then we are there, and that's what brought me to the just aha type of experience of why they have the first part of the material with the second, because we are at once both neighbors and the person that do things to the neighbors. And and so that fact that we are, you know, we're both and.
Yeah. But I think it's dangerous to start with the allegory.
Right, right.
And then, if that's what you hear first, you're probably stuck there.
Yeah. But I mean that being both at the same time, a neighbor and one who, one who's done two and one who does two.
Yeah. Well, let's see if we can't keep that in mind as we move a little farther, because I think there is a way to be on both sides, but depending on how you come at it. I think we have to ask ourselves this question. If this is primarily a story that's supposed to encourage us to help our neighbor in distress, which is often how this story has been interpreted, there are a zillion Good Samaritan hospitals out there in the world, and every church has the pastor's Good Samaritan Fund. We have one of those. If that's really the thrust of the story, then why not have a Samaritan in the ditch and a Jewish person who comes by to help the Samaritan out? That, but that's not the way, see? It's the Jewish person in the ditch and the Samaritan is coming by to help him out. And if you understand the tension between the two groups, it kind of casts it in a new light. We find out that there are two surprises in the story. Again, I didn't notice anybody falling off their chair at these surprises, but when Jesus first told the story, there were probably mouths that dropped open. First surprise is, priests and Levites walk by and do not help their fellow Jew. You're kidding, these guys are clergy. I mean, who would not help? They don't. The shocker is that the person who helps is this despised Samaritan who no one would have trusted, no one would have liked, no one would have invited the Samaritan, you know, into their house to have dinner. It's fundamental to understanding this story to grasp the point that we've got two groups of people here who do not trust each other at all. They're just night and day kinds of differences. We played around with this a little bit and thought, how could we, in a contemporary sense, recast this story with groups of people that would hit us maybe a little closer to home, groups that we understand better what the tensions are. Let me run a scenario by you, and then if maybe you'll have some of your own, we can play with this for a second. What if this were the scenario? A black person is walking through the city park and is beat up by a group of skinheads, left to lay by the side of the pathway for dead. We find a black Baptist pastor who walks by, but doesn't help. Then we find somebody from the NAACP who walks by, but doesn't help. Then we find somebody from the KKK who comes by and helps, takes him to the outpatient emergency clinic and pays for, you know. Now, most of us, I think, would say, that's outrageous, you know? No Klan member is ever going to stop and help some black person in that way. It just doesn't happen. However, it's equally as preposterous what Jesus is proposing in this parable, that a Samaritan would have stopped and helped a Jew, because all the Jews hearing the story would have said, that's nuts, not going to happen. Is that helpful? Do you get the sense of how that, it kind of grates on your sensitivities? Yeah?
One problem, all through the Gospels you see how Jesus has a problem with the Pharisees, the priests, because of all the rules and regulations they go through, the ritual purification. I always got the sense from this parable that that's what these priests are going through. They don't want to lose their ritual purification by helping this person.
Yeah. A couple things to keep in mind, though. You're exactly right. Often Jesus is attacking, especially the Pharisees and the Sadducees. There may be places, although I can't immediately think of where Jesus directly attacks the priests. And the Pharisees and the priests are two different camps. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of a nuance of difference there. But maybe more to the heart of the matter is, we're dealing with whatever the people's popular perception of these folks was. And the priest may indeed, you know, need to be held up for this kind of criticism for precisely the reasons you say. You know, they were more interested in their own ritual purification. And I have read that interpretation too, and I think it's a good one, that they may have thought, no, we can't defile ourselves with this dead person because we're on our way to sacrifice in the temple. But the common expectation on the part of the, you know, average Jewish person listening would have been, well, you know, the priests are, after all, holy people. Certainly you would expect them, if someone is desperate and dying, to help, and then they don't. But, and then on top of that, it's the Samaritan. I mean, it's not even a Jewish lay person who comes by and helps out. It's a Samaritan, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. it,
Yes.
At least you have to scratch your head and say, wait, what is this all about? Anybody else have a scenario you want to surface? I mean, can you think of other groups that would bring this tension into a more contemporary kind of focus?
I'm just thinking it isn't so close to our experience, but a Middle Eastern one or an Israeli-Palestinian one, where the wounded person is an Israeli soldier and the passerby who helps is a Palestinian youth.
Yeah. We know enough about that, I think, to understand what that would mean, don't we? Yeah.
Or that the person who is struggling is a or who is beat up on the path is an American citizen, and the person that kneels down to help them is a Sandinista.
In this book by Froissart, The Dark Interval, he had some sort of contemporary interpretations, although now they're kind of dated because this book is about 15 years old. One of the interpretations he gave in here was to retitle this parable The Good Terrorist. You know, what if, you know, use your favorite terrorist, you know, a Shiite Muslim or a Libyan or whoever, you know, what if you get helped by that kind of a person? See, then you got to say, well, the world doesn't work like I thought the world worked, which is often the thrust of the parables. Right?
Let's draw a diagram.
Do the demo.
I'm going to let you do the drawing, Brad. Yeah.
We want to
describe to you kind of graphically the reversal of expectations. So we start out, and we have a priest and a Levite.
I forget how this is supposed to be. Oh, yeah.
And the expectation is that the priest and the Levite will offer aid to a Jew. And the expectation is that if a Samaritan walks by, the Samaritan will not offer aid to a Jew. Pretty obvious. But what happens in the story is that our expectations are reversed. Instead, the priest and the Levite offer no aid, and the Samaritan offers the aid. And so you might say that our expectations are all crossed up. And so that causes us that initial shock. Like some of you, when you were gasping when you heard the KKK description.
Yeah, this is a model out of Croissant, again, to kind of diagram it this way. But you can think about a lot of parables in this format. Try it sometime. What are your expectations? Who will do what to whom, and who shouldn't do what to whom, and then you find out, wait a minute, the expectations get reversed, and you come away not sure what the rules are supposed to be.
Did you have a question?
Just a comment, maybe a question. We're talking about religious groups. In today's context, there are a lot of people that are not religious, but are humanists. Where would they fit in? And let's say the thing that we talk about, the secular humanist, someone who is concerned about humanity, but you see what I'm getting at.
Well, I think he's just saying someone, well, at least this is what I've been kind of thinking, someone who's not a Christian may be doing a very kind, compassionate deed towards someone unlovable, and then a Christian who's completely unloving and unkind towards someone who needs help or compassion. Mm-hmm. Is that kind of what you were thinking?
Well, my thought was, why do people do good? Mm-hmm. Why does a humanist do good? If a humanist does this, is it good? Maybe that's what I'm asking.
do you have a response?
I don't want to tackle that one.
Two things come to my mind. One is that the parable will always attack your basic expectations. So if there's an assumption that this is a person who will do good, we have to be ready in a parable to find out our expectation may be deflated. If there's an expectation that this may be the person who wouldn't give you the time of day, again, we have to be ready to have that turned around. I also remember someone, I don't remember where I read this, but pointing out that there is a difference between giving someone a cup of cold water and giving someone a cup of cold water in the name of Jesus. There is a difference. What motivates us to do that?
Yeah, but what motivates a humanist, let's say?
I don't know.
I've known people who consider themselves humanists,
yeah,
who have done what to us, to the general public, would appear to be very good. What motivates them? Is this parable speaking only to religious people?
Good question.
In the context of the time, it was.
Yes. I would tend to say yes.
Yeah. Well, no.
Okay.
Well, we'll
keep that on the table.
But the applications that have been given, the Ku Klux Klan, etc., have no apparent relationship with religious people. So I think I'd agree that the dynamic aspect of the parable is not necessarily whether they're religious or not, but who they are, what they stand for, and how they react to this person that they are in an antithetical relationship.
Yeah, if you notice in the story itself, the actual text of the telling of the story, more than half of it is given over to an explanation of how the Samaritan acts. And it's almost as if Jesus is saying, look, I'm going to give you all of the details here because it's necessary to overcome people's expectation that no Samaritan would possibly act that way. So here's Jesus saying, no, you've just seen the wine and the oil and the inn, and I've showed you the two coins changing hands, the donkey, the innkeeper, the whole graphic detail. Jesus spells it out so that there can be no mistaking the fact that this, in fact, is how this Samaritan acted. And so I think one interpretation of this parable is that it maybe is not so much about helping people in need, although that's a kind of salutary byproduct of it, maybe. But more than that, it's an attack on our expectations. It's back to this theme of embracing the contrary. It's an invitation to see the world differently and to grasp the point that in God's eyes, human expectations and human distinctions don't make any difference. And maybe that means whether it is a humanist or a Jewish person or a Christian, in God's eyes, our distinctions segmenting people off from one another just don't make that kind of a difference. It's a parable that strikes us, I think, interprets us in a way to try to create room for grace in our lives, to open us up, to provide that opening where something unexpected can happen. And one way to see that is that the person who we think is the bad guy turns out to be the good bad guy. Reversal.
I remember discussing this once and how, you know, this whole expectations thing. Well, this person is a bad person, and yeah, this person's always going to act bad. And when they do a good act, it makes us uncomfortable, and it makes us reevaluate our whole way of thinking, and it's almost like we don't want to admit that person did something good. Well, they had other ulterior motives that are still bad. Because then it means getting rid of our prejudices, it means getting rid of our stereotypes, and that makes us uncomfortable because that's half the reason we have prejudices, is because we like them, you know. And so I think you're right, it's just shake us up a little bit. And
the prejudices help us order the world.
Yeah.
Dwayne, you got that.
Did you just undercut your argument when you said there's the difference between those who gave a cup of water and those who gave a cup of water in the name of Jesus by just saying that God didn't make those distinctions? Mm-hmm. And
seems like you were saying two different points.
I just wondered.
I was quoting somebody else on that.
But I wouldn't. My own inclination is not to, if we were to pursue that, there was a difference between, not make a big issue about that, because mm-hmm. I think what we could affirm for ourselves, that my motivation might be because I'd be doing that in the name crops or something, but I wouldn't worry, make too much of a distinction that there was a big difference between giving a cup of water without doing it in the name of Christ.
I agree, and I'd like to think that whoever gives the cup of cold water, whether that person knows it or not, Christ is active in that person. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wherever there's love, there's God.
Well, and can I, Anne, you were saying that some of your favorite books are the Chronicles of Narnia. Right. And I think, well, I don't know how many of you have read these, they're wonderful books. But in one of them, and I'm thinking it's The Last Battle, there's a boy in there who was raised believing in the evil character, I forget who that was, and this person was actually a very giving, kind person, and in the end Aslan says, well, you actually were my child, even though you seemed to profess to believe this other, you know, evil God, you were acting in a way consistent with my love and my beliefs. So I think it was really good. Yeah.
It's, I think this parable in your diagram makes it very graphic, is saying that Christians don't have a corner on kindness. I mean, we expect that they would because of, you know, because of Christ, but we are surprised.
If there's any meaning to be salvaged from my comment about the cup of wine. It may be for me that, yeah, that has to be looked at from my perspective, not God's. And then I need to ask myself, why am I offering this aid? Is it because I want to look good, I want to be an upstanding citizen, and all that sort of thing? Or simply because I'm motivated by the love of Jesus with no personal investment in it? And that does tend to make a difference. But I think your point is the best taken way that, yeah, from God's perspective, the distinctions just drop away. Jerry.
I'm just wanting to say that I see in this parable a celebration of the presence of compassion in, mm-hmm. in the whole human family, potentially, you know, and that that is acknowledged as a source of motivation in the Samaritan. Maybe you talked about that already, but not because I came in late, but the sources of compassion are there, and the Samaritan acts on them much in the spirit of the parable of the sheep and the goats in Matthew. It's almost a Zen-like thing, you know, it's because it immediately becomes oil and carrying the burden and without great reflection on I'm doing it because of this, I'm doing it because of that. It comes right out of the source of compassion bodily, I think, into action.
That's a good point, because there's absolutely no entrance into the Samaritan psyche.
Yeah.
We have absolutely no entrance. All we see are the action.
It seems like that's a catchy place for us as Christians, is that it'll all get tangled up here and tie in a knot and then not go anywhere.
We were teaching on this parable a couple of weeks ago. We did an evening class in May for some people at a Presbyterian church near where Ann serves. And one of the people in that group had a very interesting insight as we wrapped up our discussion. And I made a note about it here. I hope I can recapture it. He said, maybe in the end, when Jesus says, go and do likewise, if we expand back into the whole framework of this interpretation, maybe one of the things that could mean is you go lay in the ditch and let yourself be helped, which is an interpretation of this that I have never really focused on. Make your needs available to people who you may not expect would be the kind of people who would help you. And one of the other people in the group told this great story about how they were driving from San Diego out in the desert to Phoenix or somewhere, and their car broke down, and they were, you know, literally in the middle of nowhere. And who stops to help them? But I can't.
The Cadillacs go by, and
yeah.
All the nice cars, and the well-dressed people, and no one stops. And then some
motley family.
Homeless family in this, one of those enormous cars that is riding on wheels, barely making it, you know. Yeah, yeah, they stopped and crammed them all in this car and took them to the next gas station.
And she was saying, you know, we don't know whether we should get in this car with these people, but what were we going to do? I mean, there was nothing for 100 miles. And they found themselves in that very interesting position of being open to being helped by somebody that ordinarily they would have said, oh, no, thanks. Maybe the parable can interpret us in that way, too, and open us to new, to new possibilities.
And that could be an answer to Mr. Halverson's question, too. You know, if you put secular humanist, quote, unquote, you know, into the Samaritan slot there. And
would we be willing to be helped, even by them?
I would. Especially if I was in the desert.
Right.
Do you want to kind of make the transition?
Let's see if we can jump into this other parable.
We just talked about the good bad guy. Now we're going to talk about the bad good guy. And the parable of the rich man and Lazarus. And why don't we turn to that, Luke 16, beginning with verse 19. But just a little background nugget before we actually read it. This is the only parable that Jesus told where an individual is given a proper name. And the poor man has the name, and his name is Lazarus. Not the same Lazarus that Jesus brought back to life in the Gospel of John, a different one. But the name Lazarus comes from the Hebrew, and the word is Eleazar, which means God helps. So there's tremendous meaning in the name itself, and particularly since it's usually the rich who have names, and it's the poor who are kind of nameless and faceless often. So even in that naming of Lazarus, there's that reversal of expectation. Sometimes the rich man is given the name Dives, but that is kind of an addition to the text of the Bible. Dives is a translation from the Latin meaning rich. So if anything, that name would just describe, you know, his state rather than his character. Well, it does describe his character too. But it's almost as if Jesus is saying we shouldn't dignify this rich man by giving him a name. He remains the rich man, and this poor man has the name God Helps.
I think maybe because we're at a quarter of ten here, can I make the assumption that we're fairly familiar with the details here, and I won't ask to read through the story. Let me just point out something about it. I think it unfolds in kind of three acts. There are three segments. Let me just quickly move through those. The first scene is the first couple verses where we have the setting described. The rich man is comfortable. He wears purple clothes. He has plenty to eat. Lazarus is a poor beggar. He lacks for food, for clothing. He's lacking in health. Apparently, he doesn't even have enough clothing to cover his body adequately because the dogs come and lick his sores at the gate. So act one sort of sets the scene. In the second act, death occurs. Both of them die. The rich man gets a burial. There's no mention of Lazarus getting a burial, which would be kind of an indignity in a sense. Maybe he was just left simply to die and rot away by the side of the road. We don't know. Interesting question that has to be asked. Could it be that Lazarus dies from starvation while the rich man overeats? While the rich man is overeating. I mean, wouldn't this be the great irony? That the food that the rich man could have given to Lazarus actually is what kills him. I mean, there he is pigging out on all this cholesterol and all these sweets and all this stuff, and he overeats and has a heart attack and croaks, while poor Lazarus has not enough to eat and dies from starvation. Food is involved here very fundamentally in this parable. Also, very helpful to remember that the, when this lesson comes up in the lectionary, and it'll happen later August or September this year, the 19th Sunday after Pentecost, the corresponding Old Testament lesson is that one from Amos 6 that we all know so well, you know, where Amos is really pounding on the rich and the wealthy. Woe to you people who lay on your beds of ivory and don't take care of the poor, don't share your wealth. That's the Old Testament background for this story. So that sort of frames up this second act where the death occurs, and we have to ask maybe why did that happen. And then we have the third act where, of course, the roles are reversed. It's shocking now to find that the rich man is humble while Lazarus is exalted. It was completely the other way around in their life on earth. Now it's switched. In life, the rich man cut Lazarus off. Now he himself is cut off by this great chasm. Notice the rich man now wants Lazarus to go and tell his brothers to shape up. And you can remember how Abraham, who's the sort of intermediary in this story, responds and says, no, that's not a possibility. Clarence Jordan, who Barbara mentioned a couple days ago in the Cotton Patch versions of the gospel, he says it this way. He has Abraham say to the rich man, Lazarus ain't gonna run no more your errands, rich man. All through life, you know, the poor Lazarus was treated like just, you know, some servant who could do this rich man's bidding, you know, boy, go get me this, go get me that, but no more, not now. It's as if to say, the scriptures are sufficient. Amos is sufficient. You want somebody to go instruct your brothers? Amos can carry the freight. The prophets can do it. He ends up saying, you know, not even somebody coming back from the dead is going to do it if they don't listen to the prophets. I remembered what one of my New Testament professors at seminary said once, which was that God doesn't say anything new. God just says the old so terribly clearly. Well, if you can't listen to Amos, you know, not even Lazarus coming back from the dead will do it.
All right. A question that kind of haunts us about this parable is, where are we? Where are we in this? We're not millionaires in American society, and yet we're certainly not Lazarus either. And yet, we know all the Global Village stuff, and we know that we, in North America in particular, are the 4 to 5% who consume, what is it, 30% of the world's resources, and that our gate are places like Ethiopia or Latin America, where the poor do starve to death, and where people die because they lack a 50-cent injection. And so if you look at it in the context of America, you might place yourself somewhere in the middle. If you look at the context of the world, where are we?
Millionaires. Yeah, that, I think, is the very uncomfortable part of this parable. We want to identify and be sympathetic with Lazarus and say, isn't that wonderful? God takes care of us in our need. Except, if we're honest, we'll have to say, what the experience we know about here is being the rich man, you know, eating all this stuff while other people starve, and it gets uncomfortable. Then we're left to ask ourselves the question, you know, where's the gospel in this story for us? Because when you look at it that way, you run the danger of saying, well, there's no good news. I mean, I'm going to end up like like the rich man, or maybe more exactly, we are like the rich man's brothers. And maybe this parable really should be called the story of the five brothers, because they're the focal point. I mean, are they going to get the message or not? Which, by the way, we never find out by the end of the parable. That question is left up in the air. Do they get the point or do they not get the point? The rich man surely never gets the message. It's too late for him. But you may remember that later on in Luke's account of the gospel, we hear about two people who are on the road to Emmaus, and they aren't seeing clearly either. They're not quite getting the point. But after they share a meal with a stranger, their eyes are opened, and they see things in a new way. Interesting again how food becomes the focal point of a spiritual insight here. You have to ask yourself, maybe if the rich man could have broken bread with Lazarus and shared a meal with Lazarus, maybe he would have understood the scriptures. Maybe he would have understood Amos. Maybe his eyes would have been opened in the kind of a way that the two men on the road to Emmaus have their eyes open when they invite the stranger in, who is Christ, you know, to share the meal with them. It's good to be reminded sometimes that the church, is not a social club. The church forces us, or should force us, maybe it doesn't frequently enough, the church should force us to rub shoulders with people that ordinarily we would not choose to rub shoulders with. And while that can be uncomfortable, the message out of Luke, it seems, is something very salutary may happen because of that. Spiritually, your eyes may be opened to find the presence of Christ in a person or in a place, in a manner, in a happening that you had never before contemplated.
We were thinking that it's awfully hard to break out of the cycle of poverty, to take those steps to move out of that. But it's a lot easier to downscale and to move down on that strata. It's as if a doctor comes in to you when you're being examined and says, you know, I have some good news and some bad news. And the bad news is that you've got cancer. The good news is that it's curable. And we might say, in regard to this parable, that there's some bad economic news and there's some good economic news. The bad news is that we're rich. The good news is that it's curable. That rich is a curable disease.
Well, what do you think?
Yeah, come.
Anybody want to be cured?
Very slowly.
What is that wonderful phrase? Not until I have my stereo.
Just to change the subject a little bit, this story and others like it in the New Testament often have been misused by the church to tell the poor and the oppressed and the hungry and so forth that this is the model we ought to follow. Just go ahead and suffer during this lifetime, and then when you die, you're going to get your eternity of reward. As if that were enough, and that's exactly what liberation theology is fighting against. And what we were talking about yesterday, this is the message that the fundamentalists and the Pentecostals are bringing to the poor and the oppressed in places like Latin America, trying to save their souls now, but not worrying about the fact that Lazarus doesn't have anything to eat.
Byron, who is it that talks about the hermeneutic of the poor?
Robert McAfee Brown?
Is that it? I don't remember.
All sorts of liberation theologians would, I suppose.
Oh, I thought somebody in particular maybe had coined that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that's one of the things that at issue here, that if there's a certain way that only poor people can read the text, that we are not privileged to. Mm-hmm. You know, we just can't see it through their eyes. Mm-hmm. So we have to take it for what we can take it as rich people, which is discomforting, but on the other hand, it's curable.
Did you have a question?
Yeah.
Could you just clarify a little bit more on how the parables interpret us versus us interpreting the parables? That's something new to it that I haven't thought about a lot, and I'm not real clear.
How can we say that in this parable? Well, maybe just this point that Byron is making, that if we're interpreting the parable, we'll kind of sit back and say, well, this is what it means for you. But if we let the parable interpret us, then we have to ask the question, well, where am I in this story? And then we get around to this uncomfortable point of saying, well, if I'm really honest, there's no way that I can say that I can identify with Lazarus here. Oh my gosh, the parable is speaking to me as the rich person. And then it starts asking questions of me about, is this the way that I respond to poor people? No. Is this my expectation about what I should be allowed to do or be privileged to do? It starts, well, last night in the Vespers liturgy, there was a nice line in that closing hymn about the story starts telling me. Did you catch that?
Mm-hmm.
Rather, it's not just me telling the story anymore. The story is telling me, and its proportions are much bigger than I thought. Is that helpful?
Yeah, that helps.
Jerry?
What, would you support allowing the parables to also interpret us, that within us there is both a rich man and there is a Lazarus? And which part of ourselves is it that we keep denying, you know, and keep in a position of that kind of miserable state, and keep rewarding another part of us, you know, that may not really be inclusive or central?
Yeah, that's embracing the contrary, that we are rich really, but what that really makes us is poor. And
right.
Until we understand that we are the poor, we can't catch the whole beauty of the gospel.
I guess I'm also thinking of it in psychological terms, or in terms of spirituality.
I would say I would support that with a little bit of reluctance, but recognizing that it is important to move to that point. The danger, it seems to me, is that too frequently Christians have jumped immediately to that point and not spent the time to sit and rest with the fact that, no, there's an awful lot in this for me as the rich person. As long as we'll give that its adequate due, and I think many of us here at Holden Village really have done that, and so maybe we are ready to contemplate the other factors, and we'll get a lot of community reinforcement that won't let us wander away from that point. But if the church had a 2,000-year history of looking at it from the vantage point of the rich person, rather than so much the other way around, I wonder what our theology would look like. I would say yes, absolutely there's a point to be made. I'd want to say just go slow so we don't miss the other point first.
And maybe getting back to that other parable where we are both neighbor and neighbor too, it would be better to not to leave out that first point, but to get the second, so that we have time for the first to soak in first.
I think many times it has to do with where you are in your own life, because you always hear someone that reads the same book, you know, time and time again, and each time they read it, they say, I got something else out of it. And I think that's because the book didn't change, you know. When they read it, they saw more in it of themselves the second time, the third time, the fourth time. And I mean, when I read John 3:16, every time I get something else out of it. And I mean, that's so ingrained, you'd think, well, you know, I hear it again and I hear it again. But I think you can get something else each time you read it. Something will stick out more.
And that may be another way to answer your question about how does the story interpret us. It told me something new this time. Not so much that I discovered something new in it. It told me something new. You know, it interpreted my life in a new way this time as it hadn't before.
But interpreting the story or interpreting the painting implies there's a way also.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, if it's interpreting us, we do change.
Well, for a while, there was a notion about interpreting the parables that there was one central point, you know, and you needed to kind of grasp that or you didn't have it. But now the method of interpretation seems to be more along the lines of this reversal of expectations, which can kind of open up the interpretation, you know, to how kind of how you read it, how it reads you. Yeah?
The thought occurred to me somewhere, and I don't remember, I never remember where these things come from, but somewhere in the New Testament it says, lest you are baptized and whatever else, you're not saved. You're saved through baptism.
Mark 16.
Whatever. Now, nothing is said here, you see. This guy was saved, he was poor, that's all we know. He was saved. That's maybe a contrary too, but... that thought just slipped by me as I was thinking about this.
One of the difficult things about this, and your comment, I don't know your name, I'm sorry, about the continual process of it, and then your comment about people at Holden probably have these ideas in mind really well, or thought about it. It's like, as much as I change my life, as you know, I earn less money, I work part-time, I work with the poor, I'm always a rich person, and so it's continually. I mean, that's because of who I am and the gifts I've been given.
And one of the things out of this parable, though, I think, is Jesus somehow communicating to these rich people that your richness is not an inherent curse on you. The rich man had ample opportunities to use his blessings, you know, to do the work of the gospel. While it's important to downsize and try to reach more of an equilibrium, I think we have to accept the fact that as North Americans, we have a kind of privileged status in the world that almost try as hard as we want, you can't get out from under it. Then the question is, can we somehow use that to serve others and not distance ourselves from the needs? The bell ringing today probably means that there's carrot cake for coffee.